My name is Dr. Merrick Felsted, I'm Pacific Lutheran University in Tacoma, and I teach theology there in Lutheran theology, constructive theology, and some courses in women's studies. And that will probably be more apparent tonight than any other session. What we've done this week is looked at all the different, first given a background of what kind of questions surround the meaning of the cross. Is there a monolithic interpretation or many? And I posted our work back here behind us so you could just kind of see where we had started off with why did Jesus die and the myriad of answers that people had offered. Who killed him? Did he have to die? And for whom is the death ultimately effective? So we were talking about all the different kinds of answers that have been given in the history of Christian theology. And then we went over some of the traditional, the most traditional atonement models the next day, the ones that have endured for the last 1,000 or so years. And then we started jumping into, last time, black theology and womanist theology, so black women's theology and some different interpretations of the cross, and that's where we left off last time. Tonight what we'll do is just look over those again and bring that conversation in while we move on to some of the some different feminist writings on the cross, Asian feminist and white feminist. Actually, we can look back in the corner. We had, we looked at first the person we concentrated on last time. We looked at Kelly Brown Douglas, and you might not be able to read that from over there, but she did a lot of work on Christology and talking about of the black Jesus and the Jesus being a black woman, that Christ is found in the faces of women, particularly poor black women, and that Christ is seen today in all who fight for wholeness and health for all the oppressed, but she really stresses the importance of black women being the face of Christ and how that can change people's mind. Looking particularly at the meaning of the cross, we focused on Dolores Williams' argument of saying that essentially black women have the history and a not so distant history, and it continues in different ways today, of being the surrogates for everyone, and for every, particularly white people and white women, that suffering on behalf of another, whether you're doing field labor, you're bearing their children, you're raising their children, what else did she talk about? So sexual surrogacy, raising children as mammy or working in the field, that black women were always expected to work harder and carry more burden than anybody else. And so that the image of Jesus as a surrogate sufferer and calling that redemption, that Jesus suffers on our behalf and that suffering on another person's behalf is redemptive, is a very damaging message of the cross for black women because it glorifies a suffering that actually is oppressive. So she talks about that for black women, this interpretation of the cross and of Jesus' death is not good, not salvific. Easter, she emphasizes in other writings, is the conquering of death. And the conquering of suffering is redemptive, is salvific, and that's where the focus needs to be, not on a glorification of the cross, and she's very adamant about that. And she's concerned more for that idea of the, for African-American women. She talks about that in other writings, she talks about God as, we could say, someone had brought up this great question of, well, if people don't really like the cross, why would you want to be Christian? You know, why not just be another religion? And she says, well, not only is she for Easter, but she's, and that message of that death is conquered in Christianity, and that's what we can focus on, that hope and that fight. But she also coins the phrase that becomes the catchword for womanist, black woman's theology across the next 20 years, which God is the one who makes a way out of no way. that God is the one who helps us survive, and that is what, the redemptive thing that God does. For the most part, we were saying atonement is sometimes about my individual sins, our kind of communal sins in this way, but she's looking at those bigger forms of sin, of systemic sin and suffering. So she does not want, she uses a quote that we had mentioned a couple times that became controversial about, we can't have this bloody Jesus on the cross as our central symbol. It's just too damaging for the women that I am speaking for. It was a bold sentence that gets taken out and lifted and put in different places. Contrary to going over Kelly Brown Douglas's work, Dolores Williams' work, this other womanist theologian, Jacqueline Bell's work, Joanne Marie Terrell is a black womanist theologian who, she's particularly relevant for tonight and in a way controversial, I think, for tonight. Because she provides a stark contrast to the people that we'll be reading. She does talk about, at the end of last class session, I had mentioned that she relates the deaths of Emmett Till, whose brutal lynching galvanized the civil rights movement, because it was so horrific in a way. She said that death, like Jesus's death, galvanized a movement, a powerful movement of change in the world. In that way, those deaths are powerful and, in a way, redemptive. So violent death can be redemptive. And she also mentions, and here's where I think it gets more controversial for tonight's topic, she also relates this or equates this to her own mother's being murdered by a jealous lover. And so when she was young, her mother was killed by her lover and murdered, and she said, can that death have some power? Can that blood that was spilled, is it simply tragedy and awful? Or is there a way, like Emmett Till and Jesus's death, that it holds some power if we remember it and if we demand things change, if it becomes a power of change? So she uses Alice Walker's image of tending our mother's gardens, essentially saying if we leave the gravesite or the garden and don't remember it at all and we don't think about what message it might have, then it is not redemptive. There is nothing valuable in it. But if I remember it and I learn from it and change and insist that other people hear it and move in some way, it can hold some power. So she writes, each of these people died gruesome deaths at the hands of oppressors or abusers. But even wrongful death, murder, and violence can have the power of redemption in it if it's remembered and tended and our lives are changed and directed towards commitments and actions of justice. So there's a variety in all of these perspectives. When we get to today's topic, I mean, this moves us into, because she talks about domestic violence, it moves us into today's authors well. And one of the things we had last time, so we have some womanist theologians. Last class was also supposed to have Mujerista, or Latin American Lutheran woman, Alicia Vargas. And we will bring her back also when we talk about Lutheran theologies of the cross and feminist critiques and appreciations of how the cross is used in Lutheran theology. But I think that might be the first part of tomorrow, and then we'll talk about imperialism and the cross, simply because I think that the work that Brock and Parker are doing on focusing on the cross as a symbol of abuse and how this ties into women's life should have some time, and we should almost leave it there. I think the end of the session should leave with their words being the case. And here's, usually I would say, you know, we have all these different voices, and I think theirs is a radical challenge to something, to a symbol that's very dear to most Christians. And what I was thinking this afternoon was not that we have to buy their argument or agree with it, but simply entertain the entertain the question of, what if this is the case? What if it is the case that the cross really is simply a symbol of violence? And there is nothing redemptive in the cross. What if it was the case that in some contexts, in some lives, this is the way? And I thought, it wouldn't be bad to just try it on for an evening. Go to worship afterwards. Having this kind of in our minds, as just living with it for as long as we could stand to live with that question. You know, maybe 20 minutes, maybe 15 minutes, or maybe a day of trying on what that perspective would look like. And what would that mean for Christian theology and for being a Christian? Where would you camp? Salvation, redemption, these kinds of things. Before we move on to them, in looking at Alicia Vargas, let's bring in, she's coming from a liberation theology basis and Latin American liberation theology. I know I spent my college years wearing a black cross that had been made in El Salvador and beyond, and we have a cross, I'm not sure actually where it came from, but in the worship center that is a Latin American kind of liberation theology. It's from Guatemala. For Latinas, Latinos, Alicia Vargas says, even in the United States, that Jesus on the cross shows God's solidarity with the oppressed. She raises this up, contrary to some of the other voices, as a very positive thing that helps us get through the day and through the struggle for justice, because she talks about that in the words of some of the women she talked to, they know that Jesus shares the slaps that they receive, and because of that they can make it through. There is, and when I was thinking about it, so Jesus shares these slaps alongside humanity. The first time she gave a paper at a Lutheran women's conference, I said, and then what? You know, like, where's the, Jesus is sharing the slaps, but don't you want him to stop? You know, and she said, well, of course. I said, well, write it in there, for heaven's sake. You know, it's not there yet. Like, you know, let's not just be slapped around and be all glad that God's being slapped with us. You know, like, and she was like, oh, no, I meant to have that in there. I said, you need to have it in there, even if you want it there. Because otherwise, the message is, it's very important while you're in a freedom struggle to have God's presence with you in the suffering and the struggle and in the awfulness. But perhaps what hasn't been as articulated in a lot of the liberation theologies I've read is that demand for it to cease. God might share it, but this will end. And I know there's the hope of the resurrection and this kind of talk of the resurrection will come. But in a way, it's interesting. I can't say that for everybody across the board, but I remember that kind of urging of saying, all right, now, and beyond that presence, do we hope? What else are we looking for? And we do have, but she has a very strong appreciation for saying that the symbol speaks very strongly to the Latina population. Latin American women in the United States, and that the cross is a very powerful symbol, and that Lutheran theology can help with this.
Seems to me the trouble with the and then what question, taking the position that she's taking, is, well, the ultimate catastrophe happened. In other words, the resurrection was after life, but within the historical context, Jesus was crucified.
First,
so the worst happened. It wasn't just he got slapped around a little bit and put an end to it. It's like he had to go through the darkness completely into the absolute darkest of dark before the resurrection could happen. So what does that say about abuse, cycles of abuse? And, you know, that seems really scary to me.
And you do have, Oscar, when I'm thinking about Oscar Romero and a number of the, I mean, they talk about, you know, we demand these kinds of things stop. The emphasis of Jesus on the cross, however, is focused on the sharing of the suffering, initially. Probably because that's the most immediate concern. Then you're talking about what we hope for and what we demand as kind of as the next step. But it is, And actually that, I think, gets into some Lutheran theology as well. This idea of the dynamics of Lutheran theology that I can find from the perspective we'll talk about tonight can be kind of scary, a little bit damaging when they're used in funky ways. And they have been. they have been in some ways. When you look at Rita Brock and Carter Hayward, you have what you, I hope you're hearing and seeing, is that there are people, strong appreciations, and when we look at Lutheran feminist writers, I think you'll see that the cross is very much a part of what they see, what many of them see as a strength for social action and change. Hope, change, this is still the central image. When we look at today, I handed out a reading that some of you may have taken a look at the from Christianity, Patriarchy, and Abuse. The article was For God So Loved the World, and the authors were Joanne Carlson Brown and Rebecca Parker. They are looking at particularly women's experience of domestic violence and suffering, and saying any glorification of suffering is nothing but negative. The hymn in the cross of Christ I glory for them would be nauseating, because they would just say this cannot be our central thing, that we're it functions in such negative ways. And they are talking about cycles. Even in our class this week, we have had stories of people saying, oh, you know what, I was raped by my pastor, and the cross was used in this kind of a way. Like, I understand what we're talking about here. This idea of penitential suffering or cycles of abuse, like you're kind of saying, this kind of bringing down in order to bring up, and who gets brought down the most, and how does this idea of domestic violence continue? The cycles of domestic violence get perpetuated through symbols of the cross. Joanne Carlson Brown and Carol Bowen claim in their article, they say suffering is never redemptive. And they say they don't even like Jürgen Moltmann or any of them who have the idea of the suffering God, the compassionate God, because they want God, again, in a way, to move beyond that. To say, okay, God suffers with us and then pulls us out of it. God is a presence that demands something to change and get out of it. To just talk about the compassion of God coming down and on the cross, unless Easter is emphasized just as much, you have a problem on your hands. And what's interesting, actually, I might have mentioned, we'll talk a little bit about Jürgen Moltmann, who was famous for the book The Crucified God in 1970. His dissertation was called, or his earliest book that was famous, was called A Theology of Hope. And then after exposure to thinking more about his experience in World War II and also exposure to Latin American struggles for liberation and things like this, he starts writing about the crucified God, and this is what catches on and catches people's attention the most. In his later years, however, in conversation with him, I was saying, so you're most famous for this crucified God, but you started with hope, and now he's writing all about his whole emphasis is on the kingdom of God coming to earth and that demand for it to be here and now and to work for that and to that we're given this kind of hope and life and this vision and that's, and I said, so have we come full circle? You know, I said, I'm looking for, you know, how would you, because I've asked other people, how would you define the arc of his career, of his theology? They said, ooh, that'd be hard to say. And so I said, well, here's what I'm postulating. You started with hope, you went into suffering, and you're back on hope. And he said, absolutely. He said, without Easter, the cross is meaningless. And Easter and the resurrection and the kingdom of God is where we camp all the power of salvation. God's with us through here, but this is where the power of salvation lives. And I was thinking, okay, well, that's quite interesting, really. Yeah.
I had a chance to talk with him. It was like, wow, this last, about a year ago, is in Seattle. Mm-hmm. And I asked him the same question because I loved his stuff, And he said, Theology of Hope was an intellectual, the book was an intellectual dissertation. Mm-hmm. And then he suffered with the crucified God. Mm-hmm. And then all of a sudden, the new hope had passion. Mm-hmm. And so it was a very, so he, it was kind of this going through the crucible, but then all of a sudden, hope had something that it could sink its teeth into.
Of where the message is. And it would, and I'd have to say, why I'm going back to him is that he would not agree with Brown and Bone, but it's interesting to put, to think about even the arc of his career, because he's most famous for this crucified God. And looking at their claims in their article, they go through the traditional atonement models and say why they're all bad, and even why the suffering God theologies, whether they're process thought, which I tend to like, but I agree with their critiques, or whether it's Moltmann, or whether if it still emphasizes too much that compassion in the dirt without getting us beyond the foot of the cross, then that isn't helpful, they're saying. Suffering, they say, is never redemptive. The cross is a sign of tragedy that grieves God, and God doesn't demand sacrifice but justice. Even the resurrection doesn't wipe out the tragedy of the cross. And I hadn't ever paid attention to that part of their article, but I think it's interesting to say the resurrection Easter morning, the cross is still the scar. The death is still, this violent death is the scar that's carried into Easter, and it's not entirely wiped out. It's still bad, even on Easter morning, that it ever had to happen. We refuse, they say, Christians are to refuse threats of death and choose life, truth, love, and liberation courageously. Let's look at, since we looked at that article, I want to step back for a moment, and I thought actually it's a little bit of story hour, but their words are more powerful, I think, than my writing things up for you all to say, give you a few from this Proverbs of Ashes book that I have in the bookstore. Some of the words of Rebecca M. Parker, who was a pastor. One of the stories that I stopped telling you about it because there was a little girl standing in the door. She talks about how this one of her colleague's parishioners was killed by her husband by being stabbed 18 times. And just saying, what messages about suffering and redemption, what messages about suffering do we offer to these people? And if in any way our theology is making this a positive thing to suffer silently and that this will be salvific in some way, then she really was troubled as a pastor as to how her parishioners would hear that and what kind of actions are being enforced by that. So she describes her shift of thought. And she also talks about it throughout the book. She mentions of her own process of dealing with violation and rape. And how she said she makes the, it's actually in relation to an abortion or some other thing, where she said, to her, the ritual of sacrifice was strangely familiar. She knew how it worked, that you sacrificed kind of what you loved and who you were for the sake of another person who wanted something or did something. And she said, why did I know this so well? Why was this so ingrained? And she makes the argument, she said, that for most of the women in her congregation, that they know this pattern of self-sacrifice to whatever end is, and that this is a ritualized, kind of internalized sacrificial imagery that's offered to women over and over again. And so she is struggling with that, of kind of working through her own experience of rape and violation, of these murders and domestic violence instances that she comes in contact with. And she says here, her shift of thought as a pastor, and she goes through Lent and Epiphany and things in here, she says, I recognize that Christianity had taught me that sacrifice is the way of life. I forgot the neighbor who raped me, but I could see that when theology presents Jesus' death as God's sacrifice of his beloved child for the sake of the world, It teaches that the highest love is sacrifice. To make sacrifice or be sacrificed is virtuous and redemptive. But what if this is not true? What if nothing or very little is saved? What if the consequence of sacrifice is simply pain, the diminishment of life, fragmentation of the soul, abasement, and shame? What if the severing of life is merely destructive of life and is not the path of love, courage, trust, and faith? And what if the performance of sacrifice is a ritual in which some human beings bear loss and others are protected from accountability or moral expectations? So she talks about that she's changing this shift of thought. She goes from there to how she's going to think about the atonement, and I'm jumping over several pages where she talks about that Jesus, she says, Jesus died relatively quickly. This is at the end of a paragraph, which means his wounds were very deep. His absence was acutely felt, and many of his followers dispersed, anguished and afraid. A few women remained to tend the body and see to his burial. They grieved deeply. Over the years, Rita and I would contemplate the meaning of Jesus' death. To say that Jesus' executioners did what was historically necessary for salvation is to say that state terrorism is a good thing, that torture and murder are the will of God. It is to say that those who loved and missed Jesus, those who did not want him to die, were wrong, that enemies who cared nothing for him were right. We believe there is no ethical way to hold that the Romans did the right thing. We will not say we are grateful or glad that someone was tortured or murdered on our behalf. The dominant traditions of Western Christianity have turned away from the suffering of Jesus and his community, abandoning the man on the cross. Atonement theology takes an act of state violence and redefines it as intimate violence, a private spiritual transaction between God the Father and God the Son. Atonement theology then says, this intimate violence saves life. This redefinition replaces state violence with intimate violence and makes intimate violence holy and salvific. Intimate violence ends sin. Behind the holy mask of intimate violence, state violence disappears. So they're working through a number of things of accountability here. A couple more phrases, and then I would like to open it up to some of your thoughts. Where Carter Hayward, I will read a little bit of hers, and then actually what I'll do is I'll keep reading a few of their things where they offer what they think then are the foci, the appropriate foci of Christianity, and what they find powerful and life-giving, and got to speak gospel in Lutheran words to them, so that you can hear their positive reconstructions, not only the deconstruction, but where they're camping things as an alternative, where they're camping meaning in Christianity. Joanne Carlson Brown and Carol Bone speak about Carter Hayward, and I've summarized her ideas up above here too, where they say, Carter Hayward makes the most radical departure, and this was written prior to Brock and Parker's work, makes the most radical departure from traditional views of atonement. She does so because she approaches the question free of some theological trappings. First, she asserts that Jesus is important if he is only and fully human. She also implies that there's no original sin in the classical sense, hence nothing from which humanity needs to be redeemed. For Hayward, Jesus' death was an evil act done by humans. It was unnecessary, violent, unjust, and final. This leads her to condemn the glorification of suffering found in traditional theology. Any theology which is promulgated on an assumption that followers of Jesus, Christians, must welcome pain and death as a sign of faith is constructed upon a faulty hermeneutic of what Jesus was doing and of why he died. This theological masochism is completely devoid of passion. This notion of welcoming or submitting oneself gladly to injustice flies in the face of Jesus' own refusal to make concession to unjust relation. Jesus died because he was a radical who challenged the unjust systems under which he lived. Jesus challenged the theological idea of a sadistic God. The image of Jesus, who in the prophetic tradition of Israel despised the blasphemous notion of a deity who likes sacrifice, especially human sacrifice, can assure us that we are not here to give ourselves up willingly to be crucified for anyone's sake, but rather to struggle together against the injustice of all human sacrifice, including our own. Along with Carter Hayward's language, another person who has spoken these kinds of words has been a preacher who's at United Seminary in New Brighton, Minnesota, Christine Smith. And one of the sermons I had heard her preach, she used the phrase at the end, she said, "As Christians, we are called to surround the crosses in the world and demand they stop." And I thought, well, that is a very, to see it as your opponent is a very different image, right? I mean, it's a very different thing. So to say, we will not allow this to continue. We won't glorify it. We insist it just ceases forever, whether it was once and for all way back when Jesus did it. And from then on, we don't allow it anymore and won't have any part of it. You know, that's one answer. But they're even saying, even back in Jesus' life, to glorify it in his life could still carry a damaging message. Carrying on their constructive approaches, I basically wrote up Brown and Bones' ideas of the resurrection doesn't wipe out the tragedy of the cross. We're to refuse threats of death and choose life, truth, love, and liberation courageously. They write that God doesn't need to be appeased and doesn't demand sacrifice but justice. And they have a sentence in here that says, "No one was saved by the death of Jesus." Period. It's one of those zingers in these theological books. Like you read, Douglas John Hall has this, you know, Jesus seems to indicate that the end of the world is coming. And he writes a sentence about this. He was, of course, wrong. You know, and I just think, wow! You know, it's like one of those sentences where you're like, okay, no one was saved by the death of Jesus. Period. Suffering is never redemptive. The cross is a sign of tragedy. To be a Christian means keeping faith with those who have heard and lived God's call for justice, radical love, and liberation, who challenge unjust systems, both political and ecclesiastical, and who in that struggle have refused to be victims and have refused to cower under the threat of violence, suffering, and death. Fullness of life is attained in moments of decision for such faithfulness and integrity. When the threat of death is refused and the choice is made for justice, radical love, and liberation, the power of death is overthrown. Resurrection is radical courage. Resurrection means that death is overcome in those precise instances when human beings choose life, refusing the threat of death. Jesus climbs out of the grave in the Garden of Gethsemane when he refused to abandon his commitment to the truth, even though his enemies threatened him with death. On Good Friday, the resurrected one was crucified. That's their last sentence in there. I get a little lost in that last paragraph.
What do you think your point was in the last sentence? I was confused.
I think it is that kind of grip on to say the redemptive thing is life and living and the power of life. It is not death or dying, or sacrifice. And so that Jesus, even, he is already the one who won't give up on life. He's tenaciously clinging to life and returning as the main message. And so it's not the death, it is that resurrected one who's, even on Good Friday, the one who's still clinging to life and insisting that that's the gospel. I believe that that's this whole camping salvation in life, not death, I believe would be their thing. And I had mentioned, you know, in these conversations, when we get to Rita Nakashima Brock, she is an Asian American feminist theologian, and Rebecca Ann Parker is a white feminist theologian. So it's not just white feminists we're reading about or their experience today, but Brock and Parker have written together. I can read we've talked about that essentially Rita Brock and Parker's ideas, violent passive death or murder is not salvific. In their book, Saved by Paradise, what's wrong with me? Why can't I remember the title of the book? It's in the bookstore. I don't have it in front of me. They talk about that baptismal water and images of paradise and not the cross were the central images of Christianity for a long time before the cross ever comes to bear as being the central image. And they want to go back to that and say, right, baptismal healing waters and images of paradise are what we expect. And that's what we'll camp our hope around, not around the cross. That's where salvation is located. In other words, the cross is not the site of salvation. Wholeness, restoration, life, water, and paradise, these are the proper sites of Christians' understandings of salvation. They're concerned with the message of the cross, like I mentioned, for women in particular. Love, courage, relationship, presence, truth, life, these are redemptive, and these are the focus of Christianity and salvation. So there's repeating going on up there. They're very adamant about it, and here's how they write constructively, and then could someone tell me what time it is? I'm sorry, I don't have a watch.
10 to 7.
Oh, good. Okay, good. Then I won't have talked the whole time, and then we can engage these people, because we have lots of different perspectives up here, and I think then we can turn it over to your own comments and questions and thoughts in engaging these people, or questions about them, thoughts on this. Parker and Brock write, in grief, the followers of Jesus found the advent of fire, the loosening of their tongues, the arrival of courage. Discovering that love endures, we come to the moment when we know that our hearts have room for more, that loss and regret have not snapped shut the clasp on our hearts. We unlock latches for repair and hope. If we are lucky, we discover the spaciousness of the heart in new loves that enter our lives and in acts of advocacy to change an unjust world. Nothing can separate us from the love of God. We make this affirmation in concert with countless witnesses who affirm the same. For us, there is nothing new in this affirmation except the newness of coming to know its truth in our own lives. Not as a message passed on to us, but as living discovery. With Job, we witness to a living truth, for I know that my Redeemer lives, and in my flesh I shall see God. Love encompasses, and that's Job 19:25-26. Love encompasses life like an arc of fire across the night sky. Presence blesses those who await it. In sensing presence, with a capital P, we embrace a passion for life. Love is a seal upon the heart, a hunger to create, to honor life, to protect it, and to see it flourish. This passion for life burns fiercely and cannot be quenched by many waters. It is as strong as violence and death. As we see more deeply into the luminous depths, we draw closer to that astonishing fire at the heart of things. And they call for, let us say, this is enough. Enough for us to run with perseverance the race that's set before us. Enough for us to stand against violence. Enough for us to hold each other in benediction and blessing. To toss out Luther's theology or epistemology of the cross is really somewhat of a separate topic. That's why I was saying we should bring it up tomorrow. It's a bit different, I think, of an issue. I could talk about, however, briefly, and I've mentioned that one of the things that stuck in my head hearing some of these voices, and also even being in preaching classes in a Lutheran context, was the, and I mentioned it earlier, is the law and gospel kind of theologies in Lutheranism, and whether these can be dynamics that carry this kind of abusive cycle into our own even worship services and theological ideas, in the sense that, let me read you a quote, if I can find it. if you went to seminary when my dad did, you read C.F.W. Walther on the proper distinction between law and gospel. Next to the Bible, this was the main text that you read, was the proper distinction between the law and the gospel. Walther has held the market on this for a long time. He's the one who wrote. One of the things he writes in, he also has some nice stuff in that book, though, and looking back at it. I went to the proper distinction between law and the gospel after reading all this feminist work on abusive theologies, thinking I was going to hate it, but I found some good stuff in there. But this I don't like. Okay, Lutheran theologian C.F.W. Walther discusses the dynamic of law and gospel in preaching. Walther advocates preaching the law in, quote, full sternness, unquote, and states that, quote, if you do this, you will be handling a sharp knife that cuts into the life of people. From the effects of your preaching, they will go down on their knees at home, unquote, and, quote, see how awfully contaminated with sins they were and how sorely they needed the gospel, unquote. And based on Walther, the task of preaching, wielding the law in Lutheran preaching, actually has been summarized in Lutheran preaching courses as, quote, drive people to their knees and make them need the gospel, unquote. That was what the, that was how the dynamic of law and gospel in a sermon's, in a Lutheran sermon was supposed to do, to drive people to their knees and make them need the gospel. And someone said, I think Chris had asked me, he said, where did this cross-examinations book, you know, what's the genesis of this? And I said, I had taken a course on pastoral care and counseling with women. And we were talking about cycles of abuse. And right, like the next day later, this was at one seminary, the next day I walked into my Lutheran preaching class and I heard that quote about driving people to their knees and making them need the gospel. And I was like, oh my gosh, it's beating someone up and handing them a bouquet. How can this be acceptable? This is our dynamic? That's disgusting. I was horrified. You know, I'm the only one. I'm like, I'm never preaching like that. I always got marks off, you know. Not enough of, you know, the dynamics. I'm like, I refuse to do that dynamic. I think it's sick. I'm not sure what I think about that. My instinct out of this other class is to think, whoa, there's something fishy about that. Walther, even though he writes about this sharp knife that's going to drive people to their knees and teach them how awfully contaminated they are, he writes in some other part, but if somebody is on their knees already, do not preach law at them, lest you push them further into the ground. And he speaks about like the most vulnerable people in your congregation and places like that. If you speak God, if you speak law to them, you're doing nothing but violence. And I thought, okay, well, if he said it too, then, you know, I thought he's on to something there. If only we would listen to that a little bit more and say, in what context can we use these dynamics and these preachings and Lutheran theology as well? So those are a number of issues and thoughts and perspectives that I'm throwing out for you. What are some of either your questions, reactions, and thoughts to either how we've been talking about or things that have been mulling around? A number of you have been at these sessions day after day. What have been some of the questions that have been, if you don't want to engage these, what are some of the questions that you're actually dealing with or mulling on currently?
Mm-hmm. I'm going to ask a question.
Yeah.
I understand how some of these liberation theologies that kind of grew out of these shared, these communities of shared suffering, Latin American-based communities, and communities that kind of have a very real, very understood experience of suffering, how that can be embodied in worship and in how they think about things together and how they talk about these issues together. So I guess my question is practically, using some of the examples that we were looking at today, kinds of very personal experiences of abuse, how do we talk about that in the community? Especially, these are often our very private issues. Mm. How do we think about that, or deal with it, you know, physiologically, in our own communities, when it's not as much of a shared experience for people?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think, actually, what one thing I do appreciate about at least Rebecca Ann Parker's book and her own narrative about being a pastor, was she said, you know, that this woman came to her and said, well, I know I'm supposed to go back, and I'm supposed to you know, this is my cross to bear. Go back to my abusive context, and this is my cross to bear, and that suffering, you know, produces endurance, endurance produces character, you know, and then, you know, and that suffering is, you know, it's, we all have our own suffering, and it's kind of redemptive in this way. And she said, theologically, I was thinking, well, right, that is the message, actually, it's kind of what I've learned, it is our message, theologically. And she said, but practically, I just told her, no, it's not redemptive. And so I think she is trying to work with kind of that you know, disparity. But it is interesting when you have the, I hear what you're saying about groups of people, and maybe we could toss that out to everybody, groups of people working with suffering together versus individual people's interpretation in a very intimate, violent setting, and how we are these two different contexts. How do we address it? Anyone want to speak directly to that? And then you had your hand up for, I think, probably a different comment.
I'm wondering if services of healing, I know they are becoming much more popular in churches, if they could be maybe taken to the next level of a service of healing, but then what's next? Mm-hmm. Could the community help people with, you know, their struggles?
Mm-hmm. I keep coming back and listening to this, to the intersection between these concepts and psychology. And my comment to what you were saying is all the work that needs to be done to unwrap the messages about suffering and abuse so that people are even aware of how they stand in respect to the cultural norms. And I think a lot about Alice Miller. I don't know if you've ever read, she wrote a book called Be Not Aware, and it's somewhat based in theology, but culturally how we have assumed, particularly from the parent and child perspective, that we are to repress any awareness of the ways in which abuse has been perpetuated in our culture. And how do we say stop, that's enough, when we have things like the repetition compulsion and the psychological history generation after generation that tends to be repeated.
Mm-hmm. And how symbolically, how responsible are we as Christians for
exactly
a symbolic repetition and support of these cycles? And I think,
Who's really the evildoer? Because the victim has been victimized.
Mm-hmm.
How do you identify the evildoer?
Mm-hmm.
Yes, the perpetrator has been victimized. So how do you even identify the evildoer?
We had...
Mine is a comment, not a question, and it's because I really share the Rita Nakashima Brock and Rebecca Parker's critique of the glorification of the cross and of suffering and of self-sacrifice, and I don't think that Jesus died to save us from our sins, and I don't think that God sent Jesus to die, but I really have trouble with the absoluteness of their critique, and I have trouble with their juxtaposing the choice of choosing life with the cross, as though those are opposites. And two of the quotes that they say, suffering and violent death are never redemptive. And secondly, we refuse the threat of death and instead make a choice for life and liberation. And it seems to me
And that's actually especially, I would actually, that quote about suffering is never redemptive.
Yeah.
I don't know whether Brock and Parker ever say it, but Bone and Brown do in their article.
Okay.
They make that
right
claim. I don't know whether they say it's never redemptive.
Okay. Well, I think it precludes this big understanding that the complexity of that sometimes the cross is redemptive. And sometimes the choice of radical justice and life entails accepting death. And I come to that because of living and working in Central America. And And I can give just the notion that, to give an example, because a village in Guatemala and the military comes in and they say that if you don't turn over your young people who are the Christian leaders, the Christian leaders, to us, because they're a threat to the military in the country, then we will kill the whole village. This is a true story. And so the village says, no, we will not turn over our young people who are Christian leaders to you, to the military. And they say, okay, then we'll kill the whole village. And the three young people who were the leaders of the Christian-based communities in the village say, yes, you must turn us over. You must turn us over because the military has a history of doing that. They would kill the whole village. Mm-hmm. And so eventually they talked their village into turning them over, and they were summarily executed by the military. And that was, they're not choosing self-sacrifice, but there in that case, it was redemptive. It saved the life of the whole village. And secondly, it was a choice, a radical choice for life and liberation and justice that then entailed death. So right. I cannot accept the absoluteness of never seeing that the radical choice for life and the cross might be inseparably intertwined.
And here I'm trying to, and for the most part, because I do want us to live with their, I want us to live with their questions for a day. And so I will argue for them in the sense where I would say there might be a way of even framing that to say, that maybe, and here I'd be putting words into Bone, Brown, Brock, and Parker, to say, no, those three deaths are still not redemptive. They're still awful, awful tragedies that should never happen. Even because those are never going to be good. They're not good. They're not redemptive. They're not, what is saving is to have another alternative or some way. They do say in that path of helping others, we put ourselves at risk. But that putting yourself at risk should never be glorified as something heroic or positive. It is something that happens on the way. But it's not they really don't want to say that that is a point of salvation, redemption, or can be glorified.
So just a quick response.
Yeah.
It seems like that's a very existentialist privileged position. Because in reality, it was salvific. Mm-hmm. It saved lives. Mm-hmm. So it would seem to me a proper response would be a paradox of it was horrible, evil, it was state-sponsored violence, it was the worst of the worst, forcing people to give up their own people to death. Mm-hmm. And at the same time, in very literal terms, it saved lives. So to me, there's a holding of a paradox there, a tension.
Yeah, and I don't think that they would go with, they wouldn't go with that, with the paradox. And if you think about their context of saying women in domestic violence, we talked in another class about saying contexts, right?
Indeed.
The importance of different contexts and how this changes interpretations. They are making a universal claim, and I think they'll stick by it. And probably in the all universal context. But in their context, there's probably no way they'd want to say that in some way this is redemptive and salvific. In another way, it's awful. They're just going to say this is just awful. And so I think they're coming out of that context, and the book before this was on the global sex market that Rita Brock was involved in, looking at the casting stones, prostitution, theology, and ethics of looking at that. And so I think in that too, the kind of sacrifice of kids. I want to get back to your comment, because we're teachers. We get to talk in other contexts. And so
I'm a teacher, so I get to blather a lot. This one's not, this is going to be like going from the profound to the mundane. But it's been bouncing around because, and maybe my experience in the parish has been unique. But it seems like, in a kind of a funny, twisted way, this is not just like these big issues, but these are things that we live out in the parish. Of the three Lutheran parishes that I've served, if they have one fatal flaw, it's niceness. that Christianity equals niceness. And so there are three or four people in the congregation that get to act out in the wackiest, sometimes most violent and destructive ways. And people never can say, stop, because Christians are nice, and they put up with it, and they bear with it. And there was one time when I actually told the choir director, this will stop right here, right now. And her rejoinder was, that's not being Christian, you're supposed to, you know, I thought you were a Christian. Well, what does that mean? Does that, I mean, so if you have this passive Christ passively going to his death, and there's no, no, this will go no further than this, that works into that. I mean, it can, you know, we can actually be living it out within our congregations, and we can be reinforcing some incredibly, in fact, unhealthy and unchristian activity by even subconsciously, on a lower level, on a day-to-day level, putting up with it, never saying no.
Other kinds of thoughts and responses on it.
Do any congregations ever deal with these issues? Like, is there an adult forum on, is the cross really redemptive, or is that if you're in confirmation in anybody's congregation?
We were talking about that, you know, that these topics often seem to stay on the level of academics. And do they have, how do they seep down into the conversations of the average Janes and Joes?
Yeah, I mean, you'd be real curious if you had some sort of canned movie or presentation that you could at least broach the subject. But
I think
it doesn't
happen. An excellent point, because I'm trying to think of what I could do in an adult forum in church as the coordinator for it to bring things like this. There would have to be so much teaching. To be able to discuss in a helpful way. Or I'm afraid people would just be left frustrated and angry.
Safety. I feel like there needs to be safety too, because it leaves people so vulnerable, you know, but if this is what they hold their faith on.
But if these people are legitimate, and this is being taught in seminaries, how do you get it down to the folks?
Well, I'm going to say things that I think it is something that we daily face or live with continuously, suffering is. And in the context of my life, I just went to visit my dad, who's dying of cancer. And my experience with my family was that my dad was suffering. And there wasn't any redemption in that kind of suffering. That in a worldly look at things from below, it's horrifying, it's awful to suffer and then to die. Even though he's 80-something and he says, I've lived a good life. For our family and for him, it's suffering. And I think the assumption under the suffering is never redemptive is the assumption that to be human is to suffer, and suffering is awful. That's the human look at it. The faith statement, suffering is redemptive, is a faith statement. And I kept thinking as I was visiting my family, where's God? And all I could think of as I came home was God is hidden. All I could see was suffering and death. And I couldn't see God. Because if I could, I wouldn't need to believe in him. That somehow God is hidden. And that the only avenue of hope for me is faith. And that I have no substance. And I go back to the third article of the explanation to Luther's Creed on the Spirit. I cannot by my own understanding or effort believe in Jesus Christ and come to him. But you have called me through the gospel and enlightened me with gifts and sanctified and kept me in true faith. That's something I think about is that somehow in the midst of human life, and this is where I think Jesus' life is instructive. God has made God's self known. So I think suffering in this context of questions about it happen in ordinary life. It happens when your parent dies or when something awful like an abuse happens. We question why. And
perhaps so, that's where we're driven to. I think if we were looking for God in suffering, I've been looking for God in washing dishes because I do a lot of that, and I think maybe God's hidden there too. If God's hidden all over the place, then maybe we don't end up with a glorification of suffering, that God is somehow only deep in the suffering, only in the suffering. And maybe you all can find God in washing dishes. I'm trying, but I just think, okay, I do this more than probably the entire, I do a lot of mundane things. God's fairly hidden in a lot of those mundane things, not extraordinary things like going to Holden, but very mundane things. So if we had a hiddenness of God pervasive across life, not just in suffering, then maybe you could avoid a glorification of, potential glorification of suffering.
So I just wanted to see what people thought of the idea that maybe there's, and I'm taking redemptive and putting meaning in, I don't know if that's fair mm-hmm. to do, but suffering, if there's pure choice, pure authentic choice, that there might be meaning in suffering. And my only example from my privileged life is my choice in childbirth to go through any pure choice. You know, I had every choice in the world, and I had medications, and yet somehow in that I had some finding of my own strength, or other people who have pure choice and find meaning because of that in suffering. Mm-hmm.
Different kind of suffering.
Yeah, which seems so piddly compared to, of course, this massive suffering, but
well, no, rare. It's every day.
Yeah. Well, yeah. So many people don't have choice.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Oh, I see. That's what's
and so happening. Yeah, and so that's I guess what I'm
thinking. Birth is happening. Oh. Yeah. So not choice, but and we're at time. I'm sorry, I should have borrowed someone's watch. So time wise, we're okay.
No,
it's time. So we can, tomorrow we'll be picking up on Luther's theology or epistemology of the cross and Lutheran feminist appreciations, critiques of that, both of those, and then moving on to I can't really think of anybody to present to you who's really into using, well, you can come up with examples for me of who's into using the cross for imperialism. The authors that I've got for you, Moltmann and Hall, are all talking about the negative ways that the cross is used to conquer the world, but I bet we can think of some popular examples of people who think it's a great thing that the cross is used in conquering the world. So we can come up with that. Thank you for tonight and the conversation. So. Mm-hmm.